The pin punched right through my dress uniform and stuck in my right pectoral muscle. Almost immediately, blood began to dribble down inside my tunic.
"You're welcome," she said, giving me a tiny, mean smile.
I'd managed not to yelp or even gasp. To maintain the illusion that all was well, I kept smiling back at her, and I nodded my thanks. Slightly put out that I'd done nothing to show the pain, she turned around on her heel and presented me with a flourish to the group. They clapped with muted popping sounds as their hands beat together. Right then, despite everything, I felt honored.
"All right," Drusa said. "Now that the festivities are over, we have some serious news to report. The Magua Grand Admiral has been on the deep link to the core worlds for days." We all sobered up in a hurry.
"Equestrian," I asked.
"What is it, McGill?"
"That can't be a good thing. Satikas is determined to do us harm. He must be appealing the legal actions of the Narbs or trying to speed them up or something."
"That's what we assume," he agreed. "He'll be calling here shortly, and he's demanded that you be present for the call." It was time for me to start sweating. I hadn't expected anything like this. I turned toward the back wall of Drusus's office, which was really a giant screen.
"Is there something special I should say, sir?" I asked.
"Yes," he said. "As little as possible, McGill. Please."
"Right. Got it."
The pin on the back of my new medal stung in my chest. I was glad we weren't wearing dress whites or everyone there would have seen blood soaking into my uniform. Satikas didn't keep us waiting for long. Drusus connected up a hollow globe in the middle of the office and signaled that we were all assembled as ordered.
"This is it?" Grand Admiral Satikas asked. "The team of grunting humans that has so wrongly sought to evade justice?"
"We constitute the officers above McGill in the chain of command, sir," Drusus said. "I'm at the top of that chain, recently given the honor of coordinating all Earth's defenses." Satikas's numerous eyes swept over the group. Suddenly it occurred to me that this honor I'd been bestowed with, along with Drusus's sudden promotion, had been a setup. Perhaps the former commander hadn't felt like facing the music with the Magua today. Wondering what fate might be offered to us, I looked at the Magua with a mix of curiosity and disgust. Damn, he was ugly. He reminded me of that time my cousin Shelby got poison oak on his balls and up his backside. I managed not to point that out, however, and felt proud of my self-control.
"Your species is to be offered a choice," Satika said. "Either your collection of star systems will be broken up on grounds you now control an illegal number of worlds due to conquest, or you will have to contribute to the Empire in a more meaningful fashion."
We eyed one another. What should we say? No one wanted to speak up and blow it. Finally, when I'd been about to blurt the obvious question in everyone's mind, Drusus spoke up.
"May we ask what our contribution to the mighty Empire should be, sir?" he asked.
The Magua eyed him again.
"There is another troublesome faction growing in a neighboring province," he said. "You would be tasked with quelling the growing threat. That would allow me to return to the core world sooner and with fewer losses."
We all frowned, not quite getting why we were being told all this.
"Grand Admiral," Drusus said, "we're honored you would include us in this conversation. But we aren't in charge of Earth. The ruling council—"
"No," boomed the Magua. "I won't hear of such nonsense. Civil authorities never supervise military personnel. That's a perversion of order I won't accept in any species."
We were stunned. Was this alien actually asking us to make this fateful choice?
"Still, sir," Drusa said, "we must consult others on a decision of such gravity."
"No,"
the Magua repeated.
"You will choose now. This is an offer of settlement. Either way, all charges against Earth will be dropped. Your species will continue to infest this region of space, for now.
We can't discuss this with anyone else?
Turov asked, daring to speak up. I said not. Are your auditory organs compromised in some fashion?
She shook her head and stepped back. Satikas's eyes swept the group, and they landed on me.
That one, the rebel. I want his opinion.
I said, I'm not fit to judge, Your Excellency.
No, you're not, but I want to hear your thoughts anyway. Will you cling to your little kingdom out here on the fringe of endless darkness, or will you go to war seeking the incomprehensible glory that awaits you even further in the void?
It was my turn to look scared. I admit, I'm sometimes a man who doesn't know his place, but I knew this was way above my pay grade. I pointed a finger at Drusus. He's the newly appointed Earth Commander. I can't go against his wishes.
The Magua said. It is as I thought. Your earlier actions were reflective of your superiors. Why else would you defer to them when asked for an opinion?
I said. That's not what I meant.
Your words reveal you, soldier. My respect grows. You have been honored today, I understand, with a trinket. Is this true?
I looked down at the shining dawn star on my chest. I nodded slowly.
What else would a soldier be rewarded for other than a job well done?
Demanded the Magua.
Stop avoiding my query. What would be your choice? Would you keep your frail kingdom and fight for it, or would you give it all up for peace at any cost?
My eyes slid from one face to another among the circle of officers. They looked scared. We all knew this was serious business. All right, I said. As long as it's just an opinion, I'd take peace. Earth could stand alone again without her new possessions.
The Magua ruffled itself and looked around at the others. Which of you creatures signaled him to make this choice?
He demanded. White-faced, they all denied it.
Very well, he said coldly. It doesn't matter anyway. You're a more clever lot than I'd imagined. I chose to ask this man's opinion because I'm sure there's no fear in his heart. Apparently, this isn't the case with all humans.
Well, Grand Admiral, Drusus began, now that you've heard McGill's choice, for the sake of curiosity, I'm sure, let's adjourn this meeting and—
No.
The Magua boomed again.
Stop squirming. I like food to wriggle, but you are just irritating me. I pose the same question to you, High Commander of Earth— with a slight alteration.
And what would that alteration be, sir?
The removal of the peaceful option. McGill already took that one.
I don't understand, sir. There's only one other choice you presented. War, is that right?
And they said you dark worlders were all stupid. Yes, that's right. Choose.
What's the point? Drusus had the balls to say. What kind of choice can be made from a list of a single option?
The point is that if you choose it, I will drop my legal actions against you and the Nerbs.
Drusus blinked, and then he stood tall. In that case, sir, I would opt to keep our conquests and go to war on behalf of the Empire.
Excellent, the Magua said, suddenly happy. I accept your offer. I hereby—
At this point, a green bulbous head peeped up into view on the vid pickup. Excuse me, the Nerb said. If I may be so bold as to request a clarification.
Satikas looked annoyed, but he didn't say anything. All of us were beginning to get it. This elaborate dance of offers, threats, and declarations was part of some kind of arcane legal process. The Empire was old, countless millennia old. And like any old political entity, it had the worst bureaucracy you could dream up.
What is it? Drusus asked. You're the chief defense coordinator of Earth?
The Naib asked.
Yes,
Drusus admitted.
You have chosen to accept the Grand Admiral's offer of settlement?
I have, Drusus said unhappily.
Very well. Committed and confirmed. The case is now at a close. Court is dismissed. All charges are summarily dropped.
The orb suddenly went dark. All of us were left staring at it, dumbfounded. I said, you'd better relay that recording to the ruling council. I'm just saying. Turov stared at me.
That's why he went to you first, she said. He wanted that answer all along. It was the only answer that would be acceptable to him.
I guess so.
I can't believe that happened, Drusus said. I lost control of the conversation. The stakes were so high, I couldn't see a way out of it.
Drusus dismissed everyone except for me. When they'd all left, he tapped my shoulder and I stayed. He looked me over with squinting eyes.
That's what it feels like, to be you, isn't it?
He asked me.
Pardon, sir?
I was faced with grim choices and put on the spot, he explained.
Damned if you do or if you don't.
Oh, right. Yes, that's exactly what it feels like to be me, sir. Drusus nodded, his shoulders slumped. He waved me off and I exited, dismissed. Chapter 65. We'd promised to wage war on an unknown alien menace in a neighboring province, but most of the people of Earth didn't know about that part. The ruling council had decided to swear us all to secrecy on penalty of permadeath. So far, we'd kept that promise. 2 months had passed since Battlefleet 921 had left Earth's orbit for a second time. The people of our world were understandably relieved. Many were jubilant. There were parties and rallies. Politicians promised the future would be brighter and different. Those they governed seemed to believe them even more than they usually did. But I knew it was all a lie. War was again in our near future. War against an unknown enemy who lived on dirt balls like ours, circling distant stars. It was the same old for me. When at last our legion mustered out, I returned home to Waycross. Etta hugged me, a shocker in itself, as did my parents. My mom wasn't in good shape, however. You're shaking, Mama, I told her, looking her over carefully.
It's nothing, just a tremor,
she said, forcing a smile on her face through her pain. That's good, I told her, giving her a smile back. You look good. I was lying, of course. She looked like she was on death's door. She was in a floating chair now, a machine equipped with padding, repellers, and a touch steering system.
Come on in for supper, she told me,
and the whole family circled around the table and ate. My dad had done the cooking, I could tell this right off, because everything tasted like cardboard, burnt cardboard. But I kept right on smiling and talking up everything all evening long. Afterward, I snapped my fingers and stood up suddenly.
What's wrong, James?
Mama asked. I forgot, I said. I'm supposed to go pick up Della at the SkyTrain station.
Della? She asked, brightening. She's coming here tonight?
That's right. You guys want to come along? One way or the other, I need to borrow the tram, Dad. He gave me a funny look. He didn't seem to buy my sudden story. But that was okay because Mama looked entranced. She still held out dreams that Della and I would form a normal relationship and raise a family in the traditional way. Well, son, my dad began, but my mom interrupted.
I want to go, she said. I never go anywhere anymore. Can she stay for Christmas, James?
We can ask her.
What about Etta?
She asked.
She's playing outside again.
I shrugged. She's fine. She'll get all the snakes, bones, and mud she could ask for. My mother made a face, but she didn't argue. Etta didn't like long tram rides. She'd rather run around outside.
I'll have to go, too, my dad said, to help with her chair.
I said, trying to think of a way to get him to change his mind. I couldn't, so I gave up.
Okay, let's go.
After we packed up her float chair, a shawl, and a snack, Mama never let anyone go on a trip without a snack, I caught my dad's arm in the garage. Dad, have you got those silver discs still? The ones we made back at the mustering hall? He frowned at me and nodded. I need those, please. He stared at me, and again he slowly nodded. He went back into the house and presented them to me. I took them and left them in my shack in a safe place. When I returned, my dad was more full of suspicion than ever, and Mama was going crazy with impatience.
Come on, let's go, she said. The last train arrives in Albany in an hour. She must be on that one, right, James?
You got it, Mama, I said automatically.
The poor girl will be waiting for a long time. No wonder she ditched you.
Oh, now that's a rude thing to say, I said, slipping behind the wheel and putting the tram into gear. We rumbled out of the garage and into the night. But we never made it to the SkyTrain station. I was revived first at about 6 a.m. the next morning. I snorted awake, bleary-eyed and itchy.
What happened?
I asked the bio team at Central.
We were hoping you might be able to tell us, Centurion, a bio said.
I don't remember. I was driving my family down in Georgia.
Hey, what happened to my folks?
The bio people looked at one another.
I'm sorry, sir, said the woman in charge. It's tragic, but there was a crash. There were no survivors.
No survivors, I said, doing my best to sound sad. Internally, I was relieved. My dad had been in the back seat, and I'd been worried he might survive in a coma or something.
Centurion?
The bio asked.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I said.
I'm all right.
Sliding off the table, I dressed and walked out into the night. A few people contacted me, giving me their condolences. The word was spreading. Della had already gone over to the house to check on Etta, and she reported back that the girl was fine. But there was only one person I was interested in talking to, Anne Grant. It took 7 calls to get Anne to answer. When she did, she looked angry and wary.
I can tell you're in town, and the answer is no, James. Stop calling me.
Hold on, hold on. Have you heard the news?
What news?
I filled her in about the tram crash, and she was horrified. Then I told her I had disc copies of them, both of them. She peered at me through slitted eyes.
James, she said, this is either one of the worst ideas you've ever had, or an extreme attempt to get me back into bed with you on a sympathy plea. Either way, you're going to fail.
No, 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 I told her. You've got it all wrong. Check the news. Do a search. They really are dead.
I died too.
She played with a tapper for a few minutes and gasped.
A forest fire? You ran into trees at high speed?
I don't remember exactly.
Why would you?
Listen, Anne, I told her. I've got the discs down in Georgia. Will you at least come with me and check out my options? Eventually, a combination of intrigue and sympathy for my loss got her to see reason. She accompanied me back down to Georgia on a commercial flight. As a Centurion, I'd been given the keys to the local chapter house for the Legion. It was there in the back of the equipment lockers that I found what I was looking for. I showed it to Anne, and she yawned.
What are we going to do with that?
It's a flesh printer, I said.
Yeah, so? You're not injured anymore.
The unit was one of the big, old-fashioned kind. Before we'd had revival machines, they'd been in vogue. In fact, they were capable of printing out a new limb or organ. Producing the coin-like silver disc copies of my parents, I jingled them in front of Anne.
Could you do it?
I asked her. You're the best bio I know. Could you print out a new set of parents for me and imprint the mental engram stored on this disk? She stopped mid-yawn, and she stared at me in horror.
That would be unethical, illegal, and maybe impossible.
Yeah, I agreed.
But will you do it?
She picked up the disks in my hand, fascinated.
How do you have these made?
It was a show and tell. My parents wanted to see where my career in the Legion had all started. Anne snorted.
What bullshit. But you've got me thinking. Could it be done?
Only one way to find out. The next several hours were long indeed. We'd arrived on Sunday after dinner time, and we had to clear out of this place by morning whether we succeeded or not.
James,
she said, clasping my wrist.
This might get ugly. There might be mistakes. I don't know if you want to stay here.
Setting my jaw, I shook my head. I'm in. I've helped bio people with difficult births on 10 worlds at least. Shaking her head, she said,
Don't tell me later that I didn't warn you.
Anne went to work after that, and I soon realized the girl was a certified genius. Rather than trying to print out limbs and organs and assemble them all into one, she just loaded the full file and began printing. At first, the sprayed-on bone cells shaped up nicely. It wasn't until we got to the meaty parts, the sinews and muscle fiber, that things got messy.
I don't think I can do it, she confessed at last. The unit isn't big enough to put a whole body into. The chamber is only about 1 meter long.
Yeah, I said, seeing that all the pieces laid out weren't going together right. Let's re-roll, and this time, she pulled off a blue, snappy glove and put her hand on my cheek. It felt hot and sweaty.
James, I can't do it. You're going to have to face facts. You killed them, and they're gone.
I stared at her for a minute, but I shook my head. Lifting up the 2 shining silver disks, I showed them to her.
Their bodies are right here. Every cell. Their minds are stored in that data core at Central. We can download the files and install them through their tappers. Don't give up. All we have to do is get a bigger printing chamber. I don't know how to do that, she said, throwing up her hands. I'm a bio, not a tech.
That gave me an idea. I contacted another girl from my past, Natasha. She was too far off to help us in person, and she looked annoyed as soon as she learned Anne was with me. But the description of the tram accident and what we were trying to do changed her mind. Natasha had always loved a technical challenge. Using my tapper to show her a live vid feed, I panned it over the steaming mess we'd created.
Your trouble is that chamber, she said. It's only big enough for about 1/2 an adult.
Right, I said. What can we do?
Show me what else you've got in the vicinity.
I walked around the storage room, showing her cartons of old junk. She had me stop when I passed a suit of battle armor. It was an antique, earth-made, using heavy steel and rubber.
That's it, she said. Your parents aren't fat, are they?
A little, I admitted. But they should fit inside there if we squished them some.
Send me the files. I'll edit down their BMIs.
I used my tapper to read the disks and transmit the massive data file. It was a good thing we'd recently upgraded our Wi-Fi at the Legion chapter house.
Okay,
Natasha said sometime later.
I've got a new version. Get out an old text box and we'll store it there. I don't want to overwrite your original files.
Got it. We worked for another hour, refitting the battle suit. At last, the girls declared we were ready for another attempt.
James,
Anne said gently,
we're low on bone meal.
Ah, I said, looking at the time. We've only got 4 hours left. Besides, I can't buy any more locally. She put up her hand to stop me.
I know all that. We're going to have to recycle what we already printed.
My eyes drifted to the skeletons we'd managed to assemble on our first try. They didn't look like my parents, although they were the right size. That made me gulp hard for some reason. I could recycle this. Hell, I'd recycled any number of soldiers on the field, but I realized that if we were short on materials on the next step, we might have to do this again. That meant I might have to take a full limb and run it through the system. A little sickened, I took the stick-like bones and ground them up, forcing them into the input chute of the printer. Natasha had helped us recalibrate the spray heads and position them correctly over the battle suit. This old type of unit allowed you to lift away from the front portion of the breastplate like two halves of a clamshell. That really helped us get it straightened out. Sometime after 3 a.m., we got down to some serious printing. The machine hummed and stuttered. It produced a strange, hot, meaty smell that I didn't like, but I'd smelled it before.
"We've got a full skeleton again," Anne said, breathing with excitement. "I'm going to engage the program for vascularity and musculature next. The organs go in last. Fill the suit with fluids, James."
It was soon a horrible stew. If you've ever looked inside the human body, I mean, really deep inside, it's not pretty. Hours later, we were left slumped from exertion and stress. We had less than 2 hours left.
"It's my dad, isn't it?" I asked her.
"Yeah. Bigger skeleton."
The skin went on next, and the whole process sped up.
"What about their minds?" I asked Anne.
"Every tapper is organic," she said, "and it contains a baseline mental program, enough for the body to breathe, pump blood, etc. We can load the full file afterward."
Okay.
We kept working, and my dad became a person in that suit. He was thinner and cleaner looking than he had been. There was no body hair other than a shock of gray on his scalp. We were always reborn without body hair. That had to grow in naturally over time. Anne loaded him with a basic mind, and he began functioning. We watched in amazement. I participated in this process countless times, but more than ever before, I felt like we'd created a living person from scratch. When he was shivering and wet, I took him out of the soupy suit and flushed it out. I almost dropped him on the concrete, and Anne yelled at me. "Sorry," I said. "He's slippery, and I'm tired."
"This was your damned idea, James."
"I know. I'm sorry." I pressed him into a pile of spare, stale-smelling blankets from the emergency supplies and left him as comfortably positioned as I could. Anne inserted the silver disc and started the mental upload, but I put my hand on her shoulder.
"What are we going to tell him when he wakes up?" I asked.
"The last thing he's going to remember is that day we visited the mustering hall." Anne made a piffing sound.
"That's your problem. I'm just here to make them live again."
Resignedly, I helped her get the second body going in the printer. It was my mom this time, and the printing went faster due to her smaller size. After another 10 minutes or so, my dad opened his eyes and groaned. I knelt beside him, and I don't mind telling you, I teared up a little.
"Pop," I called to him. "You okay?"
"James?" he asked.
"What happened?"
"We had a little accident with the tram. We're taking care of it. You'll be fine."
"I don't understand. What? Where are we?"
"Down at Waycross, Pop, not far from home."
"I don't remember any of this,"
he said, looking lost.
"We were out at your mustering hall. It seems so much colder now. Is it still summertime?"
He was befuddled, but I got him to lie quietly and rest. That was for the best. I didn't want to hit him with the truth yet. I wanted that to seep in slowly. Dying your first time around was always hard. It was even worse when you remembered how you died. At least in this case, that memory had been lost forever. Anne worked with tireless professionalism. She did a great job, and I realized I now owed her a debt I could never fully repay. My mom began to take form inside the old battle suit, and to me that was ironic. For one thing, she'd birthed me once, and now it was my turn.
In addition to that, I had to wonder how many times this suit had been used to kill in the distant past. I didn't know the answer to that, but I was fairly certain this was the first time it had ever been used as a vessel to create life. Chapter 66. After I revived my parents into slightly younger, definitely healthier new bodies, you might think they'd have been grateful. But you would have thought wrong.
What the hell were you thinking, James?
Mom demanded.
Mama, I did what I had to. You'll live now. No more nanites, no more scarring. All that was edited out by the system automatically. That's great. I died in a fiery crash I can't even remember, and now I'm living in the wrong time. Everything's wrong. What happened at Thanksgiving? Did Aunt Clara come over?
She sure did, and she loved the cooking. She slapped me hard.
Stop lying all the time, she said. Clara never appreciates anything.
My shoulders slumped, and I helped her out of the car. She could walk again, but not even that seemed to cheer her up.
It's all wrong. It's not supposed to be so cold and dark out. I missed an entire fall season. I'll never get that back.
Mama, come on, I pleaded. You're alive and well again. You didn't lose anything. You'll have a healthier, longer lifespan now.
What good is that?
She groused. But then Etta came running out to greet us. Everyone got a desperate hug.
I'm glad you're back, the little girl said. I thought I would have to fend for myself.
No, I told her. I'd never leave you, doll. Not ever. We went inside and were surprised to find the place was trashed. Etta had taken over the living room and the kitchen table with her bony exhibits. Mama gritted her teeth and gave me an up-down motion of the eyebrows. I knew that meant she wanted me to act as the heavy and kick out the girl's nasty toys. After some gentle effort, I managed to do so. It was clear to me that the girl had thought she'd owned the place, and she'd immediately taken over the main house. Trying not to get angry, I helped her remove all the offending skulls and other things she'd gathered and move them into the backyard where they belonged. After a few days of settling into their new bodies, my parents began to cheer up. They were upset all over again by the following Monday, however.
Our claim has been denied, my father shouted. I can't believe this. I paid for over 30 years. I have a legit death certificate, everything.
That's insurance for you, Mom said. They always weasel.
Are you talking about the tram, Dad? I asked in concern. Is the insurance going to replace it?
What? Well, sure. They will, despite the fact you were driving.
But it's my term life I'm talking about. They reviewed my case, and they've denied the claim. I blinked at him, then laughed out loud.
You tried to make a claim against your life insurance?
Of course. I died, didn't I?
Yeah, Dad, but you're alive again.
Does that matter?
He said, smacking the policy with the back of his hand.
The contract says it pays in the case of unexpected death. If that's not what happened, I don't know what is. I'm looking into this. I'm getting a lawyer.
Shaking my head, I walked away. I could have told him the company would never pay. They'd known about Legionnaires and our special ways to cheat death for a long time now. There were sure to be clauses to prevent shenanigans like what he was describing. That night, I slept hard in my shack, but a tiny sound woke me up. I sprang to my feet, fumbling out a combat knife. The lights went up, and the snarl on my face died.
Etta, what are you doing lurking around here at this time of night? Get back in the house and go to bed.
She looked outside the cracked open door, then looked back at me.
Are you sure that's what you want?
Frowning and scratching, I went to the fridge and dug out a beer.
Yeah, I'm sure. What are you looking at? Another fox in the yard? Possibly. But she could be much more dangerous than that.
I whirled around, spilling my beverage. Moving to the door in 3 strides, I pulled it open and flung it wide. There, lying face down on the porch, was a young woman.
What did you do, girl?
I demanded, giving Etta a shake. She glared at me, trying to remove my grip, but I didn't let her squirm away. She wasn't good with authority figures, and she had a bad temper in her. I checked the woman on the porch and saw, with relief, she was still alive.
"She was trying to sneak up to your house,"
Etta said.
"I acted to save the family."
Snorting, I lifted the woman's hair to one side. It was about then that I recognized her.
"Sarah? You know this person?"
Etta asked. "She's from my unit.
What did you do to her?" "A strike from behind works wonders. I didn't hit her hard. Her brains shouldn't leak out."
I glanced at Etta.
"Sometimes, girl, you're too ornery for your own good. This lady was just shy, and she probably came to see me privately." "Why?"
Well, sometimes, ladies and gentlemen..."
"Sex?"
Etta asked.
"You think she wanted sex? That's disgusting. I'm glad I hit her."
"Etta, you're going to stay here and apologize. She's coming around."
"I won't,"
she said, and she ran off into the darkness. My teeth were clenched in anger. I'd brought home a monster, a barbarian that bashed people's brains out in the middle of the night. Sarah groaned awake and sat up.
"What happened?"
she asked.
"Did you hit me, Centurion?"
"No. I have an overactive guardian living here with me. Come on, let me help you up." She brushed away my hands and got up on her own. I appreciated that. After all, she was a Varus regular now. A knock on the head was no big deal to anyone from my legion.
"I heard you were in an accident,"
she said, massaging her neck.
"That you were presumed dead, but you survived the crash."
Glancing down at my fresh body, which wasn't scarred, bruised, or even abraded in any way, I felt embarrassed. "I caught a revive, actually," I admitted.
"Well, then,"
she said stiffly,
"I'm sorry to have disturbed you, Centurion. I'll be on my way."
"Hey," I said, calling her back. She turned slowly, eyeing me over her shoulder. She had narrow shoulders, wide hips, and a face like a pixie. It was a look I appreciated. "Come on in. Have a cold one," I suggested. "After all, you came all this way. We can talk about the campaign." Sarah paused, despite the fact we both knew what her decision would be in the end. Still, she rubbed her head and pouted in the yard.
"I didn't hit you, girl,"
I said. But she still didn't move. "Oh, well," I said. "Do what you want." I went back inside, put a second beer on the table, and sat down on the couch. I'd left my door ajar. Soon, a small, attractive face poked its way inside. She reminded me of the foxes Etta kept locating somehow. The night wore on, and Sarah kept me company. By morning, we'd both forgotten our troubles, our ranks, and the whirl of bright stars overhead that one day soon would call us back to fight among them. This has been an Audible Studios production of Rogue World, Book 7 in the Undying Mercenaries series, written by B.V. Larson, performed by Mark Boyette. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Neil Basic. Copyright 2017 by B.V. Larson. Production copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.